Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. When we talk about the country we love and protecting it against foreign enemies in particular, there was a development last year that unmistakably inspired every enemy we have on the planet to believe that they could engage in intensified aggression against us with impunity. They took the measure of Joe Biden in the crucible of Afghanistan and found him seriously wanting in terms of the kind of leadership that has given them problems in the past, and thereby caused them to believe that they could become, to our detriment and that of our friends and allies around the world, more powerful, more assertive, and more dangerous. A man who has as keen an eye as anyone in America today for the kinds of dangers that I'm speaking of, who chronicles them arguably better than anybody, and certainly at a higher velocity than anybody I've ever met, is our guest. I'm very proud to say for this full hour, we're going to drill down on one of his most recent books, published by, again, I'm very proud to say, the Center for Security Policy Press. The author's name is Robert Spencer. He runs Jihad Watch, a marvelous project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. You can follow his work at jihadwatch.org, also at Front Page Magazine and PJ Media, where he publishes columns with great regularity. And I hope that most especially you will get your hands on, at Amazon or elsewhere, Who Lost Afghanistan, the book we're going to start off our hour-long conversation discussing with Robert Spencer. Robert, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us, and thank you for giving us a full hour of your time. It's a treat to be able to visit with you at length.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you. Let me start by asking you about this proposition that somebody lost Afghanistan. It wasn't that the Taliban won. It was that they actually secured the victory by acts of commission by the United States government. Have I got that right?
Oh, absolutely, Frank. Yes. Every time the United States military engaged the Taliban on the battlefield, the U.S. won. Every time. But the war was lost in Washington, D.C., and it was primarily lost right at the beginning and right at the end, although there's no doubt that it was certainly very severely mishandled all through. So from beginning, middle to end, it was botched, but it was wrongly conceived, wrongly executed, and wrongly ended.
We'll come to the execution in a moment. Of course, we'll drill down on the ending, but let's start with the conception out of the gate. We were attacked on 9/11. It became fairly clear, fairly quickly, that these prime suspects were the beneficiaries of aid and comfort and support, logistical and otherwise, in Afghanistan under the leadership of the Taliban. What did we get wrong in that concept?
The part that was most gotten wrong was the idea of what exactly we would do once the Taliban was gone. The Taliban was effectively defeated, or at very least driven from power, by November 2001. It was a very rapid victory. And then for 20 years, we tried to establish a Western-style secular republic in Afghanistan. And that's where it all went wrong. The difficulty was that the Bush administration, followed by the Obama administration, and then the reluctant assent of President Trump, and then certainly the Biden administration, all thought that this kind of state, a state that would be friendly to the United States, that would protect women's rights, that would have voting for various leaders, and no established religious law and all of that, could be easily established in Afghanistan. And the Washington policymakers and the political analysts never dealt with the strong loyalty of the Afghan people for to Sharia, to Islamic law. And that foredoomed the project from the beginning, because if you believe Sharia is the law of Allah, the perfect and immutable law of the one and only God, then you're never going to exchange it for a system of laws that's established by human consensus. And that was the fundamental fallacy in the thinking of the people who put together the strategy and the goals for the Afghan conflict.
You know, I'm so interested in this because what we've been impressed by is that early on, when it came time to formulate a successor government and a constitution by which it would run the country, an American professor, I believe of the name of Noah Feldman at Harvard University, gave them a draft that enshrined the centrality of Sharia in the Constitution. How does that square with what you've just said about our aspiration to have a secular or multi-religious state, when it seems as though actually we were signing on to, the worst of it, if I can call it that, namely kind of Sharia supremacist one?
You're absolutely right, Frank. It all stems from the same kind of willful ignorance and willful misunderstanding regarding Islam. When Noah Feldman framed a Sharia constitution for Iraq, and I believe also Afghanistan, certainly in Afghanistan, it was all patterned in the same way, he never gave any indication of realizing that such a constitution was in fact in conflict with the idea of a pluralist state that the American policymakers envisioned, because they had swallowed in Washington completely the idea that Islam is a religion of peace that is perfectly compatible with Western models of society and governance. This was all propaganda fed to them by Muslim Brotherhood organizations such as the Council on American Islamic Relations and others. And so as a result of believing and buying everything that these propagandists were telling them, they didn't take into account sufficiently the fact that core aspects of a Sharia society are in conflict with the kind of society they wanted to establish. So they ended up putting in a Sharia constitution and thinking they would still be able to have a Western-style secular republic. It was based on a fundamental misunderstanding of what Sharia really is.
So we had a very different view, which we were incessantly continuing to advance, that was at odds with the Constitution that we had encouraged them to promulgate. And to your point about the Muslim Brotherhood and its influence operations, Robert, as you know, we were very much alarmed back in this period, immediately after 9/11, especially, of the successful influence operations that the Muslim Brotherhood was mounting at the time against the U.S. government on precisely this point, obscuring, you know, the true character, not of necessarily the way lots of Muslims, including in our own country, practice their faith, but the way the authorities of the faith say it is supposed to be practiced, and certainly as it's practiced in places like Afghanistan. So here we have a conflict. And Robert, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a bit about how it was not, in fact, satisfactorily resolved. We'll be right back with more with Robert Spencer, who lost Afghanistan, and more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The kangaroo court known as the House January 6th Committee has finally brought its serial miscarriages of justice to an end, predictably by referring criminal charges alleging former President Donald Trump incited an insurrection that day. But there was no insurrection. The committee's highly selective investigation notwithstanding, Mr. Trump bore no responsibility for two factors that principally enabled what were mostly peaceful incursions inside the Capitol that day. First, the building had a reduced level of security, not a heightened one, including several open doors. And second, there were clearly provocateurs in the crowd, some of whom appear to have had ties to the FBI. There may have been a conspiracy to influence the 2020 election certification proceedings. An honest investigation, however, would find evidence pointing to the culpability among the congressional leadership, not those targeted by this rigged one's trumped-up charges. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. Robert Spencer is our guest for this full hour. We're talking first and foremost about one of his newest books. And when I say newest, that means it's been at least a couple of weeks. And I think there's one or two more since. He is prodigiously productive, which I'm envious of, but also deeply, deeply admiring of. Robert, we're talking about Who Lost Afghanistan? And you've laid out that we got the, there's the cover of it. I don't have it with me, but thank you for showing it. You were talking about having misconceived what we were about from the get-go, and that was partly a function of misunderstanding the nature of Sharia and the determination of its adherence to eschew, not to say violently oppose, the sorts of things that we were trying to promote there, whether it was equal rights for women or whether it was religious tolerance or whether it was, you know, the promulgation of man-made laws and the like. And so as it came to the execution phase, you've made a distinction between the military and its successes on the battlefield and a sort of strategic failure to understand, as I said, what we're up against. And presumably that translated into how to fight it as well, did it not?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it did so in a number of ways. One of the primary ways was the impossible rules of engagement that made it extraordinarily difficult for our forces to gain any traction against the Taliban because they had to wait and be fired upon first and so on, and all manner of restrictions that are unrealistic, really, in a time of war, where sometimes one makes difficult choices in a split second, and it's a matter of life and death.
This was in part a function, was it not, of this idea that we had to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan people?
Exactly, and this leads to the next problem, which is that we went about trying to win the hearts and minds without having won the conflict. After World War II, Germany and Japan were thoroughly defeated, and only then was the Marshall Plan to rebuild them implemented. But in Afghanistan, we were doing Marshall Plan style building of roads and schools and hospitals and so on without actually having secured the country and defeated the enemy decisively. And so our military was also diverted into those aspects of the conflict, which weakened our force there. And it was self-defeating from the beginning, because here again, this is based on a misunderstanding. The Quran says that the Jews and Christians will never be happy with you unless you discard Islam. And the Taliban and groups like it portray any kinds of hearts and minds initiatives on the part of the American military or any non-Muslim force as an attempt, a devious attempt, to be nice to the Muslims so as to entice them away from Islam. Now, obviously, this was nothing like what we were trying to do, but it made the Hearts and Minds initiatives barren and useless from the start, because they were only regarded with increasing suspicion by those whom they were supposed to win over.
This raises a couple of themes that I want to develop with you in the course of our time together here, Robert. Far from trying to induce Muslims to abandon their faith, it seemed that sort of a centerpiece of what came to be known as the COIN strategy, the counterinsurgency strategy, the Hearts and Minds effort, was to insist that our men and women in uniform, diplomats, I guess, as well, but specifically the troops in the field, submit to Islam. Was that not sort of part of the mistake here?
Oh, very much so. You have female personnel wearing hijabs. You have the order not to say anything about the widespread sexual abuse of young boys, because the commanders that we were trying to hold as allies were engaging in it. And this is very widespread.
On military installations, yes, we were based on. Yeah.
And you have the fact that the Afghan putative allies could be armed on those bases while our own troops could not be, subjecting them to green on blue attacks by jihadis who infiltrated into the Afghan forces, the police force and the military, without our being able to discern that they were there, because of course the American military and political establishment was committed to not seeing any ideological problem at all at the heart of this conflict, so they couldn't possibly screen for it.
And just talk for a minute about submission and the importance of that in Islam. I mean, it's the name, I guess, of the faith, in fact. But how did that play into all of this? And in particular, you know a lot about the cultures of these nations as well as their faith. What's the attitude towards people who, well, the powerless are treated, I guess, badly, but those who have power and are seen as lacking the resolve to use it effectively?
Well, that's a very good summation of General John Allen, who was the commander of our forces in Afghanistan for a few years. And this was during the time when the news went out that there had been Qurans burned on American bases. Now, a lot of this was false rumor. Some of it was just custodial matter, and a custodial matter and not a desecration at all. But in any case, John Allen went on YouTube, and you can still find his English language message on YouTube, issuing a most groveling apology to what he called the noble people of Afghanistan. Now, that kind of effort is seen in Washington and was seen in Washington during the Obama administration when all this happened as an attempt at conciliation and a demonstration of respect intended to calm the situation. But the Afghans would only see that in terms of strength and weakness and see that the great American power was actually quite weak and was submitting already to Islam, and that consequently it was time not for a gesture of mutual respect or of kindness returned to kindness shown, but rather to step up the hostilities in the face of that weakness.
And that's really Quranic, is it not? I mean, that's baked into sort of Muhammad's perfect example.
The Quran says not to make peace with the infidels when you have the upper hand. And John Allen, not knowing the first foggiest thing about the Quran, played into that and showed you have the upper hand. So he was inviting them not to surrender, not to conciliate, not to negotiate, but to press all the harder against the American forces.
For whom, again, I think it's fair to say there was considerable contempt rather than admiration because of that restraint, perceived submission. And again, in the tradition, again, not of all Muslims, thank goodness, but of those who are fully adherent to the Sharia program, this redoubling of their efforts to achieve, you know, the victory, the triumph, the dominance, that there is their due, according to Islam, is only intensified by this kind of perception that the enemy is weak, irresolute, or simply hapless. And that brings me to kind of the end game of all of this in Afghanistan. And we have a hard break coming up here. So let me just put the question to you, and then we'll answer it on the other side. After 20 years of misconceptions about what we were trying to do and execution that was sadly doomed to fail, we came to the denouement on Joe Biden's watch, 6 months or so into his tenure. And we're going to talk with Robert Spencer next about how that played out, condemned perhaps to that inevitable outcome, but nonetheless brought to pass by Joe Biden and his policies. We'll be right back with more with the author of Who Lost Afghanistan, right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome once again. We are visiting with Robert Spencer, one of the great, analysts, commentators, and raconteurs about some of the most important challenges of our time, notably, but hardly exclusively, that posed by the Sharia law and its adherents of Islam. And we're talking about it in the context of the subject of one of Robert's newest books entitled Who Lost Afghanistan, published by our Center for Security Policy Press. Very proud to have Robert as one of our senior fellows at the center. And Robert, we've talked a little bit about the mistakes made at the very beginning of the Afghan liberation effort after 9/11. We've talked about the 20 years of horrific, difficult slogging in trying to transform the country into, as you put it, a sort of Western-style secular democracy at unbelievable cost, both in lives, most importantly, and those who maybe survived it but did so badly damaged. And then just in the costs of, taxpayer expenditure, trillions of dollars, as I understand it. And I guess I ask you to sort of bring us up to the moment when in the summer of last year, the Biden administration decided to pull the plug on the whole operation.
The end was comprehensively botched. It was so botched that it's hard to believe that it wasn't done on purpose. You would really need experts who were trying to figure out how can we make this as much of a disaster as possible for it to have been as bad as it was, but it was. And what happened was, in the first place, the Biden administration had months. They knew they were leaving. They knew when they were leaving, but they did not prepare any plan for leaving in a safe and orderly manner, even though they had months to do so. And I'm not a military man, Frank, but I can tell you that even I can see how it could have been done so much more efficiently without any loss of life. And the key to that is Bagram Air Base, which was the American base there in Afghanistan that we abandoned in the dark of night without notifying our Afghan allies in the summer of 2021, with our American personnel and American civilians still in the country. If we had not abandoned the airbase first, we could have gotten all the civilians there, gotten them out, gotten all the military materiel out, and then gotten the military out. Nobody's lives lost, because the Bagram airbase was a secure area. But by abandoning it, we made everybody have to go to the Kabul airport, where ISIS killed 13 American service members, and where many, many civilians were unable to get out and were abandoned there by the U.S. State Department, while all these people are clinging to the aircraft, horrible scenes, and all of it was preventable.
You kind of alluded to it, but one of the other things, of course, that was the consequence of this unbelievable hash-up with respect to Bagram was we wound up leaving, by some estimates, $85 billion worth of advanced weaponry, much of which we have reason to believe has not only been scarfed up by the Taliban to turn them into the world's most powerful terrorist organization, but also disseminated to their friends around the world, and not least probably to the Chinese and Russians for their benefit in sort of reverse engineering these systems. To your question, Robert, could this have been anything other than by design? Have you really sussed that out to your satisfaction? Could it have simply been sheer incompetence on an epic scale? And what are the countervailing indicators?
There are several considerations. One is that the military under Biden has become amazingly politicized and is seems primarily concerned with waging the culture war and enforcing critical race theory among the troops, in making sure the troops all have the COVID vaccines, in weeding out alleged insurrectionists, or that is supporters of the former president, from the troops, and so on. And instead of studying how to win wars and how to carry out operations efficiently, it's making sure that everybody on military bases is okay with having drag shows and things like that. So that's one thing, that the military is involved in a massive dereliction of duty at this point. Then you have the still unexplored connections between the Biden family and the People's Republic of China. And you've got to wonder, people were waving away the leaving behind of all this military materiel in Afghanistan, saying the Taliban won't know how to use it. But the People's Republic is right there, and they know how to use it. And so it's not so simple as all that.
You know, there are several different aspects to that particular point that is worth discussing too, Robert. The Chinese, of course, had interests not only in the weapons, or for that matter, in Bagram Air Force Base itself as a fabulous installation, you know, fully up to U.S. military standards. They were interested, obviously, in seeing us lose a war, the more ignominiously, the better. But they also had interests in the country, notably, you know, rare earth minerals, lithium and the like, that they wanted to exploit, you know, to an even greater degree than they did while we were there, amazingly. And I guess the question that that came up in one of our Committee on the Present Danger China webinars the other day, I think it was Garrett Ziegler, was talking about the fruits of his deep dive into Hunter Biden's laptop. And one of the things that he came across was that a company that Hunter had been invested in was involved in the extraction of lithium from Afghanistan. So just to add further to this, you know, theory of the case, is it possible that the Biden family not only was doing the bidding of the Chinese and throwing in the towel in a manner that was humiliating and deeply demoralizing to our military, as well as I think our population more generally, but was doing it for profit as well, personal profit?
You know, I think that it's an extraordinary scandal that Hunter Biden's obvious influence peddling has never been investigated and probably never will be. It's an indication of how deep the corruption goes in the American government, but it seems to me that it's entirely possible when you have the son of, at that time, the Vice President of the United States, and he gets this incredibly lucrative position in an oil company in Ukraine. Ukraine, very interesting, that he has no qualifications for whatsoever. The influence sale is quite obvious, and yet no one seems to care in the Justice Department, and they're quite busy with other priorities that show how deeply politicized they are. And so it seems to me that this is one of the foremost issues of our age, is to what degree did Joe Biden carry out the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan for his own personal gain vis-a-vis the People's Republic of China? But will we ever know for sure, or what the details are? Probably not at this point.
Well, suffice it to say for this discussion that it would be bad enough if it were done to the benefit of the Chinese and no personal profit or benefit indeed to the Biden family. It's just icing on the cake if that were the case. And I have to say, you know, we've been discussing this a lot on the program, Robert, and I'd welcome your thoughts on it as well. The extent to which, as you say, this is a scandal of epic proportions is bad enough. But to the extent that it is a counterintelligence catastrophe that we have in the person of the President of the United States, someone who our friend and colleague Sam Faddis has described based on his experience running agents for our government's Central Intelligence Agency for quite a number of years. This is an individual, Joe Biden, who is actually a, quote, controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party. And that, you know, makes this spectacle of what happened in Afghanistan and what has flowed from it and what is offing elsewhere in the U.S.-China dynamic dramatically more frightening, alarming, and really, you know, existentially threatening to our republic. We're going to pause for another moment. Robert Spencer is with us talking about who lost Afghanistan and much more, as a matter of fact, and we'll get into the consequences of what happened with that loss that abide today and are arguably becoming more serious with the passage of time, with the author of Who Lost Afghanistan. We'll be right back with Robert Spencer to hit all of these topics and more on the other side of this very short break. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the war of ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back. We're visiting with Robert Spencer, one of the brightest guys in the universe, as far as I'm concerned, certainly on matters that we care profoundly about here at Securing America, specifically the survival of the United States and the enemies that abound that seek to have it be otherwise. Notably, a special area of expertise and incredible productivity is Robert's work on the jihadists among those enemies, those who subscribe to Sharia supremacism and seek to impose it on the rest of us through whatever means is available and certainly whatever is necessary. Robert, just to conclude the thoughts about the end game of Afghanistan, is there any doubt in your mind that the adversaries that we face, whether they're of the Sharia caste or the Chinese communist sort, the Russians, the North Koreans, the globalists, for that matter, have taken note of what happened here, believe that Joe Biden lost Afghanistan, and are now redoubling their efforts to take advantage of the vacuums of power and the weakness and the irresolution, and for that matter, the contempt that I think many around the world now have for not just the president, but for his country as well.
Oh, there's no doubt about it whatsoever. And we see U.S. allies around the world meeting with Chinese leaders, meeting with the Russians. They look as if they are preparing for a post-American global order. And that is squarely the responsibility of Joe Biden and his handlers in demonstrating the weakness of the United States. And of course, our societal divisions don't help and are trumpeted before the world with the people in power exacerbating the divisions all the time, every day. It's very easy for our enemies to grow confident.
Let me put a proposition to you, Robert, and I don't think you disagree with it. I can't remember if we've actually discussed it in quite so many terms, but in the context of this loss, as I've mentioned, we have a plethora of adversaries. The Chinese communists, I think, foremost among them. The globalists who are, you know, admiring at the very least of the Chinese communist model, if not full-throatedly so. And then there are the Islamists. They all are totalitarians in various fashions, and they all have, it seems, somewhat different end states in mind. And it'll be very interesting to see, you know, how it might sort out. But what they all have in common, and what they seem very comfortable doing, is collaborating to bring about the removal of the impediment to each of their desired end states, namely us. Have I got that about right? I mean, are we watching in the persons of the Taliban and all of those who are glorying in their victory over the United States, in the Muslim world in particular, a sense of, you know, putting aside differences, notably with a Chinese communist regime that is genocidally oppressing co-religionists in order to achieve their immediate objective of destroying the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems as if these various authoritarian forces have decided to unite on the basis of their shared authoritarianism and to target what is still the foremost exponent of free society in the world, the United States. And then probably once the United States is gone, they intend to turn on one another. We can remember that in the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Tudeh Party, the Communist Party, sided with Ayatollah Khomeini against the Shah. And then as soon as Khomeini took power, he had them all arrested. And this is the kind of thing we'll probably
see. And executed, I think, by and large.
Indeed. Yes. And so should it come to that, there will likely be the same kind of infighting. But I do also think that the left doesn't have a problem with the proliferation of Islam, because Islam does teach that you obey the ruler in any circumstance. And that obviously lends itself to authoritarianism. In 1400 years of Islamic history, there is only Turkey that is not an authoritarian state. And even Turkey, as it re-Islamizes at this point, is becoming more authoritarian. So they
and really, it only became something else because Ataturk explicitly rejected
correct.
The Islamist model, did he not?
That's quite right. And so the globalists may think this is a religion we can live with, and we'll let that proliferate, but we'll restrict all the others. Certainly, that's how they're behaving at this point.
This gives rise to something we've talked about before, and you've chronicled in various books over the years, the red-green axis, as it's been called, the willingness. And I can't quite tell whether they think it's a faith that they can control, or whether it's simply one that they will be able to make, as I say, common cause with for some interim period, and then the long knives will come out. Robert, we're going to have to take one final break here momentarily. And as we do, I guess one of the things that I want to explore with you, because I believe that you were really one of the first victims of a phenomenon that is now much in evidence, in fact, shockingly so at the moment, thanks, among other things, to Elon Musk's revelations from the inner workings of Twitter, namely the role the Federal Bureau of Investigations has been playing in the United States in recent years. And as I say, I think you were one of the first who fortunately survived, but nonetheless was very much a target of misconduct by the FBI before it became apparent in the Donald Trump context, or in the context of, you know, this laptop from hell, Hunter Biden's and so on. So we're going to explore all of that on the other side of this very short break. I hope all of you will stay tuned to hear more from Robert Spencer about what is arguably a huge challenge to the internal security of our country, namely the folks who are supposed to be protecting the FBI. Be right back with more right after this. Welcome back. Robert Spencer is still with us, I'm very pleased to say. We have been talking about a number of different topics, beginning with his important new book, Who Lost Afghanistan? And now pivoting a little bit to some of his personal experiences in the fight against the jihadis inside the United States. Robert, you have been writing extensively and brilliantly about you know, what those who adhere to Sharia are doing, whether it's under the banner of the Muslim Brotherhood or other terrorists inside the United States. Sadly, their numbers, thanks to the loss of Afghanistan, have just increased, well, exponentially, I'm afraid. 70,000, 100,000 people, most of those guys that weren't hanging on the outside of the planes but were inside them coming here, we think probably more likely to be Taliban than people who actually helped us in the course of those 20 years of struggle in Afghanistan. But talk a little bit about your experiences in Garland, Texas, where you had occasion to discover the FBI was not playing for our team in the fight against these jihadis.
This was back in 2015, Frank, and it was indeed the first indication that I personally had that the FBI was not really on our side. This was the Muhammad Art Exhibit and Cartoon Contest that Pamela Geller and I co-organized and presented in Garland on May 3rd, 2015. And the idea was to make a stand for the freedom of speech at a time when jihadis worldwide had made it clear that they were going to kill people who drew Muhammad. And so we thought, if we submit to that, bullying and intimidation, we'll only get more bullying and intimidation. So we wanted to make a stand for free speech. There were two...
Let me just interrupt to say that the reason they were so opposed to drawing of Muhammad was, one, it would cast him in a negative light, I guess, but also just the sheer fact of creating a representation of him was considered to be idolatry under Islam. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. And it's forbidden according to Islamic law. So this was another thing we were trying to show. Also, we were not exactly ready to submit to Islamic law. But two jihadis came all the way from Phoenix to Garland, Texas. I believe it's an 8-hour drive, in order to kill us. And they opened fire in the
parking lot. Kill you and Pamela and presumably as many as they could shoot up in that audience too, right?
That's right. And they opened fire in the parking lot, but we had a lot of security around the building and they were shot dead. Now, as it turned out, later we discovered that there was an FBI informant who had been in touch with them for quite some time before the event, but the FBI never notified us that there was any threat. As a matter of fact, they explicitly told us there was no threat that they had discerned. And the FBI informant followed the two jihadis into the parking lot of the event. He was right behind them and encouraging them, writing to them in texts, "Tear up Texas." And the FBI, although they knew about this plot and they had their informant right there, they had nobody on the inside to protect us. They had, I mean, if I had been an FBI agent and I'd heard that there was an event with 300 Americans in it and they were going to come shoot it up, I would have had 100 FBI guys ringing the building. They wouldn't have gotten close. But it's only because we hired security on our own that I'm right here talking to you today. And it seems that the FBI, I think, during the Obama years, they wanted to make an example of people. Remember, Obama had gone to the UN and said, the future must not belong to those who slander the prophet of Islam. Well, we hadn't slandered anybody, but I think the point was clear. He wanted to make it so that no Americans would think that they were going to resist Islamic law.
And making an object lesson of you and Pamela Geller, of course, would have been a twofer if they were able to essentially remove the thorns in the side that I think it's fair to say that you both have been to the jihadis and their sympathizers for quite some time. And to your credit. And I think what's to your credit is not that you're Islamophobic, but that you are truthfully describing what these jihadis believe, what they specifically perceive to be their divine mandate to engage in, namely violent attacks on those who oppose them and their forced submission as a result. And I can't thank you enough, Robert, for the decades that you have spent mostly thanklessly putting forth such truths, enabling many, many others. I have no idea what the total impact has been, but I suspect it's vast. To perceive accurately, despite official narratives to the contrary, to say nothing of the taqiyya, as it's called, of the Muslim Brotherhood and their ilk, that are designed to confuse us about this Sharia regimen and what it entails. You have done a huge public service, and you continue to do so with the books that you have been churning out, and I thank you for all of them, most especially those like Who Lost Afghanistan that we've done together with the Center for Security Policy. So we have only just about a minute left, Robert. I want to leave with the thought, what's the principal takeaway from this most recent book and really your body of work that you'd like our audience to have?
That we need to reject the politicization of intelligence analysis, such that instead of dismissing a realistic view of Sharia, as was done, and that led to the disaster, the 20 years of disaster in Afghanistan, we have to acknowledge the truth without fear or favor and act upon that, no matter what the political cost, or real or perceived, may be. And that should be the lesson of Afghanistan, but nobody's drawing it.
Well, your book lays that out handsomely, and I hope that programs like this and others in which you're participating will give voice as it needs to be to this important lesson, and that it will be learned maybe by the next Congress. We'll see, for starters. Robert Spencer, thank you, my friend. It is always a delight to have a chance to visit with you, even if some of the information that we have to impart is not cheering. It is vital, and I commend you for it. God bless you, my friend. Have a good holiday season. We'll talk with you in the new year. We'll be right back. Thanks to all of you for being with us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us do just that, and that you will go forth and multiply.